probably need headphones.
No. I might use them. Just a word of warning, Wendy. I'm having a serious eyeglass issue, so I hope that it isn't reflected in anything I do during the show, but my usual glasses that I would be wearing have broken on my way in today. So the tops, the part that goes right over the eyeglass...
These are the now hip grandfather glasses,
right?
That our grandfathers used to wear. That have made a comeback. Ray-Ban makes them, or the dollar store where you got them.
Yeah, I got four for a dollar at the dollar store.
Did you go to the quarter store?
Yeah, they have a quarter store. it's like Amazon Express, but for the dollar store customers. So on the way here, what happened was, the tops of both sides, so the plastic piece, the dark black plastic piece that goes over both sides, has snapped at the hinge. So when I put them on, it looks like my eyebrows are up in the air as though I'm startled. Right?
Joe Marks.
But they're thin.
They're thin.
He looks like a surprised woman.
Yeah.
I'm sorry,
Did this
just happen a couple months ago?
No, these have lasted me.
I thought you broke your glasses a little bit ago and you were wearing Bertrand's.
In the spring. Well, that's what I'm using as a backup. Steve Bertrand's not here in person, but in spirit he is because I'm using his backup glasses.
You know, Judy, keeping him alive through his glasses.
And Judy Pilak, speaking of keeping her alive, has a bunch of them in here.
Does she need
some girls ones.
All
they
right.
look nice on you, I think.
I might use those.
Is that why you went in the drawers in the newsroom?
Yeah.
There were a bunch in here. I don't know where they are.
The newsroom has a special section of things like that, like last-minute emergency things. I think there's some deodorant in there, although other people have used it, so that would be strange. And I don't need it because it's just my glasses. I haven't worked up a sweat yet.
Maybe that's why they came unglued.
That could be why. I don't know why. So just know at some point during the show when you look up at me and I look like I'm a startled woman, I'm not. everything's fine. A quick thank you to everybody who came out or who listened to the WGN Walk of Fame on Friday. Boy, was that fun. I know you weren't able to be there, and I'm sorry you weren't able to be there, but it was so much fun.
I listened, so I'm one of the ones who listened. You and Bertrand did a great job.
Thank you.
I had some family matters I had to tend to.
Yes.
And you were very entertaining,
and
what a great class.
It was a great class. Everybody there... the four people that were inducted certainly were all deserving, but without a doubt, the greatest moment was Marlene Wells getting a standing ovation. You've been to all of these that we've had. Everybody is well-respected and well-deserved, but nobody has received a standing ovation. But hers, as soon as we said her name, everybody just rose to their feet, and it was very emotional.
Well, here's the thing. Marlene is a behind-the-scenes planner for everything and has been for 52 years, so she arranged that standing ovation for herself.
That was not made clear to us.
No. I think her husband, Rich, was the first to stand, and then everyone said,
she deserves it.
I can't remember who it was that stood up first, and I think it might have been Lyle Dean.
Maybe.
Because I was way in the back, so I could kind of see. And it could have been Lyle Dean that stood, and then everybody, it's Lyle, you know, and it's Marlene. We better stand.
What kills me is she's been here 52 years and still has a bright and sunny disposition.
All the time.
I mean, anytime
Every
you
day.
Need anything, she will handle it as best she can.
Yep.
Wouldn't you be so sick of us?
Yeah.
And she just does it by, like, I walked into the kitchen because we had lunch here afterwards, and I came into the kitchen, and she looks at me, and I came up to her to say congratulations. She goes, oh, Mary, the food is over there to the right, and
always
the drinks
working.
Are here. I'm like, seriously, Marlene? Stop. This is your day
to
be honored.
You saw her on site at the museum. There were a million things going on, and she was in the center of each one of them. Even though she was being honored, there was no downtime.
Yep.
She's just
organizing the pictures. And
she can't sit back idly.
No, I don't think she really can.
No, that's her nature.
So.
And Rick, her husband, I love that they met here.
Yeah.
It's just really kind of a love story and shows what this place is. It's truly a family.
Now, the other great moment is one, I know this isn't fair, but it's one that I can't tell by myself. Dean Richards has to also tell it with me. And that'll happen on Thursday when Dean is on to talk about the movies coming out over the weekend.
You're doing a four-day tease?
I'm doing a four-day tease. I may have just broken the Guinness Book of World Record for a long tease. But I can't do it justice. He has to tell half of the story.
All right.
All right?
We
but on Thursday when we have Dean on, I will tell you something that I never in a million years thought could happen, but I watched it happen and Dean was involved, and that's all I can say right now.
And tomorrow night is the big WGN TV 25th anniversary special. Will Marlene Wells be on that?
I don't know that she'll be on that.
She should be.
Oh, she should be on every special. Did you see her on the Alec Baldwin roast last night?
I did. That's so weird.
She did a great job.
Did you watch it?
Worked a little blue.
I DVR'd it.
I watched the whole thing. And actually, when we come back, I want to talk about that because that special, it kind of parallels something that's happening in real life. So we'll get to that in just a minute. Stick around. Big show today. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
White Sox, what about the Bears?
Yeah, they won.
By a field goal.
Yeah, very, very last
second. Take that, Cody Parker-y, Parky. What's his name?
Cody Parker.
Okay.
All right.
I bet he wishes we'd forget.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. All right. So here's a little confusing conundrum I find myself in the middle of. I watched this roast last night. You know, you've taped it, but only watched part of it. It's the Alec Baldwin roast on Comedy Central.
On every channel, we noticed as we were trying to tape it.
Yeah. Everything Comedy Central owns, they aired this special on last night. It was on, like, the National
MTV,
Network or MTV.
Country Music Television.
Yeah. It was all over the place.
C-SPAN.
Yeah. You got to see how much of it?
I saw nothing.
Nothing?
No.
All right. You're
ready
to watch it tonight?
Yes.
Very enjoyable. Extremely dangerous.
How so?
I mean, well, because they do what you do at a roast. They make fun not just of Alec Baldwin, but of everybody else on the panel. There's no safe ground. I mean, if you're gay, as some of the members were, you're made fun of. If you're another color or religion, you're made fun of. If your religious beliefs, if your political beliefs are different from anybody else, you're made fun of. It's what the roast was set up to do. You know, and I know that sounds awful, and I'll explain more about that in a second. But it's as politically incorrect as you can possibly get. In a time when everybody is going out of their way to try their best to be politically correct, it's the exact opposite.
But you can't change the roast, can you? Or
no.
It's not a roast anymore.
You don't want it? No. And several members of the roasting team, most notably Adam Carolla, made that his thing. That's why they're there, to rip on each other. They're not there to be safe and politically correct. And they're not. I mean, there's several. I don't want to give too much away, but there are several things that are so shocking that your jaw just drops open. You go, I can't believe somebody in 2019. I can't believe somebody just said that. That happens quite a bit. So the parallel for me, anyway, is what's going on at Saturday Night Live, where they hired three new cast members, and one of them, Shane Willis, I believe is his name. Am I getting it right? Shane Gillis. I'm sorry. Shane Gillis.
Gillis. What are you talking about, Gillis?
Right. Right. They unearthed some audio of him doing a podcast with another guy where he's saying incredibly racist things, mostly about Asian people, but not exclusively about Asian people. They've gone back and found other times, other conversations in this podcast where that's what these two guys do, is they just talk off the top of their head. And sometimes it gets very, very racist. So Saturday Night Live is in a weird position right now where they have hired this guy. He's one of three new cast members. One of the other cast members, by the way, the first Asian cast member that Saturday Night Live has had in their whole run. You
know? Now, wasn't he a writer, if I read this correctly, last season
yeah.
or maybe the last couple? And
yes.
That's the
yes.
first one.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. So they're in a weird position. They have not commented since these tapes have been unearthed. And you almost have to hear them because I'm trying in my head to figure out why, in one way, the way of these roasts, I can sit there and enjoy it because it really is very, very, very raunchy. I mean, really.
But you know what you're getting when you tune into that.
You know what you're getting, and in my head, and if I'm wrong, I apologize, but I don't think I am. They're going out of their way to be as politically incorrect as they can possibly be because that's what the roast has always been. So staying true to tradition, I know you can say, well, but there used to be things like slavery. That was once a tradition. Do you want that tradition to continue? No, absolutely not. But for this thing to work at all, which comic did we have on recently who explained to us that comedy can't be politically correct? Was it John Lovitz? I think it was John Lovitz who said that.
It was tough to pay attention during that interview, so I'm not sure if it was him.
For all of us, for him,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I think it might have been him.
I think it was the great prophet John Lovitz.
And his dog, Jerry.
And his dog, Jerry, who said that for comedy to actually work, it cannot be politically correct, because that's what comedy is you're bending the rules. You're saying things that are outlandish, and he's right.
Yeah.
Lovitz is right once again. Curse you, John Lovitz, for always being so right. So I watched that special last night. It's 2.5 hours of them being incredibly incorrect in every way, shape, and form, and laughed throughout. You know, I was as shocked can be that they got away with the things they got away with. I don't even, people would go, well, give me an example of it. No, you have to see it to believe it. It's amazing. If you've ever seen The Roast, you know what I'm talking about, but they've outdone themselves this time.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing. All right, so why can something like that be so okay with me? But then when I find out about this guy on Saturday Night Live, this Shane Gillis guy, and I listen to some of the tapes, it's awful.
That's the thing.
It's awful.
If something's funny and you laugh at it and it gets a reaction out of you because it's funny,
right?
That's one thing. And right. It doesn't mean because you laugh at a politically incorrect joke that you're politically incorrect. Funny is funny, and especially you coming from a stand-up background, you've made a living at this.
Yeah. Yes.
And I mean, on the radio every day, funny's funny. If you get a reaction out of something, it's like you look at a painting. If you get some kind of reaction like, oh, that calms me down, or oh, that amps me up.
Yes.
You can't
change
your reaction to something.
You're right.
You can change how you act to something, but you can't change your reaction. So funny's funny. If this guy was funny, I don't know, maybe.
Well, you know, interestingly, that's exactly what, it's hard to believe, but Andrew Yang, the presidential candidate for the Democrats, weighed in on this. Somebody
asked him. I got my
$1,000
from him, by the
way. Did he send you your money?
Yeah.
I didn't think he would do it.
I went to his website and I was the first one to register.
And he sent you $1,000. Thank you, Andrew Yang. So they said to him, what do you make of this? What should Saturday Night Live do? And he said essentially what you just said. If something's funny, go for it. I don't think anything this guy said was funny. And I'm not just going to say this guy and his partner. I listen to like 10 minutes of these guys' podcasts. It's horrendously bad. It's them just being angry and bitter and racist for no reason at all. That's just what their show is.
And is this something he has currently been doing, or is this from years ago?
The tape that got him in trouble was from 2018. It was last year. But then they have since gone back and found other instances of him doing that sort of thing. Somebody flagged that one. And actually, one of his comedy teachers, one of the people who was running some comedy theater that he worked, said, we had to let him go because he was so racist both on stage and off that we had to let him go. That's why when Saturday Night Live hired him, we were confused by it. Like, is that how they want to represent themselves with a guy like this?
Question to you.
Yes.
If I may borrow a term from Dwight Schrute. Question.
Yes.
Don't you think SNL would have vetted him and looked around for things?
I'm shocked. I can't believe
they
didn't.
Maybe they did. It gets people talking about it. Gets people tuning in, does it? I don't know.
It gets people tuning in. And actually, my wife said their very first sketch when the season opens in a couple weeks should be that guy and their new cast member interacting in some way, shape, or form.
Oh,
that
should
be the very beginning. But you know that old adage, there's no such thing as bad publicity? I don't agree with that at all. I think if you're Saturday Night Live, you're shaking your head going, there's an internet now. We could have looked this guy up. We could have done a little bit of research.
They know there's an internet. They had to have been aware of this. They had to have. If you were hiring someone, I don't know if it's legal or not, but wouldn't you kind of look at their social media and Google them?
But they've been so responsive in recent years. There was a criticism a couple of years ago. you're not getting enough ethnic cast representation. And they did it immediately. They said, you know what? You're right. We're not. And they've changed that. It took them way too long to have an Asian cast member, obviously. This is the first time in 46 years that that's happened. But they've been so responsive to that kind of thing. And there's people today, the guy who wrote one of the Saturday Night Live books, the last Saturday Night Live book, he was just quoted today as saying he expects them to let this guy go. He goes, I'd be shocked if they kept him. The season premiere, I think, is in 2 weeks.
Don't you find it puzzling that one of the three new cast members has an issue with Asians, and then also one of the three cast members is an Asian?
Amazing.
I'm sorry.
What strange timing is that?
coincidence or
I know.
Planned.
I know. So what do you, if you're them, if you're management, to say, if you're Lorne Michaels and you know all this is coming down right before opening night, what do you do? Do you get rid of this guy? Do you have a stern talking to this guy? He has said since the story unearthed on Friday, I'm a comedian, you know, I'm trying my best, you know, to be cutting edge. Sometimes I hit, sometimes I miss. He goes, there's a lot more misses than hits. You know, he's trying his best to deflect it. Doesn't make it right.
I don't know, Bill. That's an interesting assessment. We have to think about that.
Yeah.
We should explore that on the stream as well, too.
All right. We can do that. All right. Let's take a break. We'll get you some news. Keir Dulay, Wendy, from 2001, A Space Odyssey.
One of the best movies of all time. Is that on your top 10?
No, it's not in my top 10.
I
love
it.
It's in your top 10. All right. Well, when he's on, I'm going to tell him it's in my top 10, but it's not.
Okay.
How's that? So don't, when I say to him,
all right,
you're in my favorite movie of all time, don't go, you didn't, you just said it wasn't.
I got you.
Because I'm going to say it was, but it was not.
Bill's a liar.
It's my 85th favorite movie of all time. All right, some news is next. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
All right, Hal. I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Are you getting as stressed out as we are?
Yes. Keir Dulay joins us right now. You know him and love him as astronaut Dave Bowman in that movie right there, 2001 Space Odyssey. Keir Dulay, be honest, you still get chills, don't you?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's an extraordinary film. I'm just very lucky to have been chosen to be in it because it was made by one of the geniuses of the history of, in the history of film, Stanley Kubrick.
What was it like working with Stanley Kubrick?
It doesn't get better. He was an extraordinarily clear and wonderful human being to work for. Never got excited, never raised his voice. Was open to suggestions, didn't mean he used them, but you never felt shy about suggesting something. He was wonderful, and you just knew every moment that you were in the presence of genius.
Keir Dulay is our guest. Like I said, he was one of the stars from the 1968 classic 2001 A Space Odyssey. You'll get a chance to see that film and meet Keir Dulay and involve yourself in a discussion about the film at the Pickwick Theater. It's part of the Pickwick Theater's classic film series in Park Ridge. It all takes place Wednesday, September 18th. It's a thrill for Wendy and I to talk to you, sir. But let's go back to Stanley Kubrick for just a little bit. We always hear stories that he was such a perfectionist, and he would sometimes shoot scenes 15, 20, 25 times. Was that your experience with him?
Well, certain scenes which were very technically difficult to light, he would try different lighting effects on the subject many, many times, and that sometimes required a lot of takes. But I think that may have increased as his career went on. I don't remember very many takes for the intimate scenes. If there were a lot of takes, I don't remember. I just remember that it was always extraordinary working with him, and it was always interesting because it never was. He was open to change. I mean, I don't think he had decided yet what the end was going to be exactly like. until he got there.
Yeah.
What about your shoes? Didn't he have a problem with your shoes at the beginning?
He was a perfectionist. The first day of shooting with me, I mean, they've been shooting the film. We were the second section of the film to be filmed. The first section of the film was Dr. Floyd on his way to the moon, going to the space station and finding the monolith on the moon. Second section was my section. And the last thing to be filmed was the beginning of the film, which was the Dawn of Man sequence. But the thing about my shoes, the first day of shooting, he noticed he didn't like my shoes. So he didn't think they were right. So we didn't shoot that day. We shot the next day. That was my first day.
Hmm. I'm sure that people have asked you this question before, but at what point did you realize, I'm part of something really, really big? This is a landmark film that'll last for centuries. What was going on when you realized that?
Well, that realization was really in two parts. When I saw the film, I really thought that I was an important link in a masterpiece, but that I would be invited to the Cannes Film Festival 50 years later for a special salute to this film, it never occurred to me. Can you imagine if you'd been interviewing the actors in Orson Welles' Citizen Kane?
Yeah.
At the time, but those of actors guests that in the year 2019 that this film would be studied in film schools?
No, it's amazing, you know, isn't it?
So the same thing. So that, yes, I knew I was what I considered a masterpiece, but it took, you know, for what of the world, there were three major premieres. One, the world premiere was in Washington, D.C., the next one was in New York, and the third was in Los Angeles. And in one of those, I don't remember which, 200 people walked out. The reviews were very mixed. I mean, 50% were not good at all. And MGM was worried until they began to see that within weeks, suddenly there were lines around the block. And the audience that made up those lines were, for the most part, the young generation. It was the same generation that were protesting the Vietnam War.
Mm. How about that?
I just wonder, it was not doing well with the critics. What changed that it took off? Because it is such an epic film.
I think it was word of mouth, and there were some wonderful reviews. But in fact, there were a couple of reviewers, well-known weekly publications like Newsweek, for example. I think there was another one where the critic obviously changed their minds, and a couple of months later came out with another review that more or less said I was wrong. But I think it was the word of mouth of all those people that were lined up. It was the reason I think a lot of people were very confused, because it was such a different kind of film. It was really, I mean, it has two of the great moments for me. My favorite part of the film is the Dawn of Man sequence.
Yeah.
It's got two elements. It has what we call in the business a jump cut. It has one of the greatest cinematic jump cuts in the history of film, and that is when the leading ape man, after the victory over the other group of ape men, throws his bone, which has become a weapon recently in his life, he throws it into the air, and in slow motion, it rises into the air, and you just see it in close-up, and it morphs into a space vehicle. Well, Kubrick never explains what that space vehicle is. That space vehicle, and I didn't learn myself about this until years later, was a nuclear weapon that is in constant orbit around the Earth, because Arthur C. Clarke, the author who worked with Stanley Kubrick on this project, kind of saw that in the year 2001 that the Soviet Union and the United States would have a standoff, and that each of those powers would have nuclear weapons in orbit around the Earth. So you have a jump cut where the first weapon in history morphs into the most recent. And my other favorite moment in the film is when the ape suddenly gets it in terms of that weapon that he later uses, the bone. There's a scene where he's kind of idly fiddling with some bones, almost seeming to play with them with no intent. And suddenly, in mid-stroke, one piece flies off, and he stops. And you know how a dog, when it's very curious about something or sees something very unexpected, a dog will kind of tilt its head? Well, that's exactly what the ape man does. It's a brilliant moment. It is the moment when the penny drops that humankind makes a huge giant step in its own history and discovering the first weapon.
We're talking with Keir Dulles, one of the stars of one of the most important movies ever made, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Are you amused at all the different interpretations that this movie has brought forth over the years? Because everybody who sees it has a slightly different version of what means what.
Well, I don't know that I'm so amused. I'm delighted because I think that is part of the magic of this film, is that it can hold so many different interpretations. But I remember one of these premieres, there was a nun who said it was one of the most religious experiences in her life.
Wow.
But atheists love this film
yeah.
also.
Yep.
And, you know, there was they had long-term bookings in those days with a hard ticket, almost like getting a ticket to a Broadway show. And it was played for a long time in San Francisco, and apparently, I heard this at the time, somebody probably having smoked a funny cigarette or more, ran down the aisle screaming at the top of his lungs, "It's God! It's God! Jump up!" And ran right through the screen.
You know, I'm kind of a science geek, and you guys were scientists on board, and you were very smooth and not nerdy. How did that happen? It was a very different scientist.
We had long discussions about the makeup of the personalities of these characters, and we all came up with the fact that most likely they were... both Gary Lockwood and myself, had double doctorates in various scientific subjects, and more importantly, that an event that would cause you and I to run screaming out of a room would only cause he and I to raise an eyebrow. In other words, that we had such cool personalities. And the other thing is, you know, there's very little dialogue in this film, as you may remember, because he and I have been in space for months. Everything's been talked about. There's nothing we know who our relatives were. We've talked about our schooling, blah, 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 blah. So all that's left is the daily, somewhat boring routine that we have to perform every day. There are only three of us that are awake, the computer, Hal, and Gary Lockwood's part, and myself. And so that's why there is so little dialogue. As a matter of fact, I didn't have to worry about memorizing long speeches at all. There was only one speech where it was difficult for me to memorize, which did not end up in the film because Stanley Kubrick, when he was editing it, just decided that the scene was redundant. He had another scene when Mission Control was talking to us, so he didn't need me speaking to Mission Control with the same subject matter. But because it was technological gobbledygook, it took me... I started working on it for a couple of weeks before I knew we were going to shoot it. And to this day, this is 50-some years later, I'll give it to you in a second. It went like this. I'll do it very quickly.
All right.
Mission Control, is this X-ray Delta 1 at 19020 on board Fault Prediction Center and on 9000 computer. Show Alpha Echo 35 unit is possible failure within 48 hours. Request check your in-ship system simulator. Also confirm your approval or plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 35 unit. Prior to failure, Mission Control, is this X-ray Delta 1 transmission concluded. But it was never showed, never ended up on the film.
Wow. You remember that 51 years later? That's not bad. That is
we filmed in 1966.
Wow. Keir, in the years that have followed, in the last half century, we've had dozens, if not hundreds, of movies where technology comes back to bite us, where technology says, you're a man, I'm technology, I'm going to win this battle. But I can't remember it happening much before your movie, did it?
I don't remember. I mean, the amazing thing is to remember that when 2001 was made, there was no such thing as computer-generated special effects.
Yeah.
Everything you see in the film, it's amazing, was done physically, one way or the other. And I don't think there was anything that was shown in that film that nothing major was shown in that thing that has been shown to be incorrect.
I did see an old Twilight Zone with Wally Cox, and he was in love with a woman, and he was working with the computer, and the computer got jealous, and that was 1964.
Wow.
That's
so
the only other thing I remember.
That's it.
Oh, well, they were ahead of us. No, interestingly enough, though, about 6 months ago, I got back. I was asked to come to New Zealand to be a part of a Universal Pictures will be releasing it, but it was made by a New Zealand company. It's a very interesting film, and it's the name of the film is the documentary. It's a full length documentary being released by Universal. It's called We Have to Talk About AI, Artificial Intelligence. We Must Talk About. And what it really goes into in great detail is all the pluses, but also a lot of the minuses that are on the horizon. And there are a lot of minuses. There are a lot of things to be worried about when it comes to artificial intelligence, including dangers to our health. I won't go into that, but there's a lot of new indication that having an iPhone on your hip all the time when you're ready to receive calls is not good for your health. But I won't bore you with reasons. But there's a lot of stuff that's coming out like that.
Oh, good. Good, good. And Keir, I always promised myself if I ever did get to meet you, I know what a landmark film 2001 was, but you were so great in David and Lisa, and I know that's an obscure movie.
You.
But boy, were you great in that.
Thank you. I suspect, I don't know this for sure, but I suspect, as I remember, that may have been the film that Kubrick based his choice on, although it's such a different kind of character, it's hard to do it, but I don't know what else it would have been. You know, I had no idea I was being considered. I was doing a film opposite Laurence Olivier in early 1965, directed by one of the most unpleasant directors I've ever worked with, by the name of Otto Preminger, and it was called Bunny Lake is Missing, and I came home after shooting one day, and my wife said, you got to call your agent. He's very anxious to talk to you. So I called him. There was a time difference, so I called him the next morning. And he said, the next day, and he said, are you sitting down? I said, no, why? Well, you better sit down, because you've just been offered the lead in Stanley Kubrick's next film.
Wow.
I had no idea. I didn't meet anybody connected with it. Had no idea that I was being considered.
Go meet Keir Dulay.
Pod Bay doors open at 7, as you will be interviewed on stage by film historian Raymond Benson. This is all happening Wednesday night. The Pickwick Theater Classic Film Series in Park Ridge. Keir Dulay, thank you so much. It's such an honor to meet you.
Well, thank you. It's been a very pleasant interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Keir Dulay, everybody. Keir Dulay.
Amazing.
Yeah.
All right, quick break. More show. It's Bill. It's Wendy at 720 WGN.
Thanks, everybody, for all the very nice texts we've received about Keir Dulay, the actor, one of the actors from 2001, A Space Odyssey. There was one in particular, Wendy, that you read to me. I hope you remember which one it was. It was the one about him today and technology.
Oh, yes. Somebody said... Wait. Does Keir use any technology like Siri and Alexa and get creeped out? Darn it, I wish we saw this earlier.
Well, it really is. I mean, I know it's 51 years past what happened in the movie, but it does kind of all tie in, doesn't it?
It really does.
And I'm always kidding when I say at some point, I think I'm kidding anyway, I hope I'm kidding, that I say that those things will eventually turn on us and destroy us. I like to believe I'm kidding, but in the movie... didn't go real well.
No, I know, and you've brought that movie up several times every time we talk about these automated cars.
Yeah. Yes.
Because it's like, yes. You know, what if you want to go shopping, but the car wants to go to the zoo?
Right.
What happens?
Who's going to win that battle?
The car.
But, like I said, there have been so many movies since 2001 where technology goes, you know what, I'll take the lead on this, thank you very much. Everything from the Terminator movies to Demon Seed, the list goes on and on and on. But when this happened... In 1968, when they showed that, the audience was just shocked that something created by man could turn on him. It's like in Planet of the Apes, when you find out what happens at the very end, and the audience... I mean, now we've seen so many movies where that's the plot, that's the twist in the plot.
Yeah.
But when it first happened, everyone's like, wait, what? What? What happened?
This is when I turn into Fox Mulder and trust no one, or no thing.
That's the best way to do
it. Trust no thing.
Trust nothing, yes. You're right.
I was not here last week, at the end of the week. Eddie Money passed away. That one killed me.
Yeah.
I'd been watching his reality show with his family, and I know that it was announced that he had esophageal cancer, and usually when that announcement comes, it's
soon
faster. Thereafter.
Yeah.
And I'm very upset about Rick Ocasek of The Cars.
Boy, me too. He was such a mainstay. You and I are roughly the same age. We're
the same age.
You're a little older than
me. I'm 6 months older than you.
So one generation removed.
Oh,
but that music, the Cars music, just for us growing up, that was part of the landscape of the land. That was you just heard the music no matter where you were. It was on every radio station. It was on all over MTV.
And do you remember, you might think, I heard Steve Grzanich do a report this morning that was like the video of the year, one video of the year. Do you remember that, where he turned into a fly?
Yes.
I'll never, and
very
he kind
disturbing.
Of looked like a fly. He had the most giant Adam's apple of any man ever.
I think because he was so thin and wiry, his Adam's apple was more prominent, but it was right out there.
It was like an Adam's watermelon. And I'm not making fun. I loved him.
Was.
And he found love in a model, Paulina Poroskova.
Which you don't see very often, your rock stars and your models getting together.
But they were married quite a few years. I was shocked to find out that they had divorced, I guess, as
recently.
Of last year.
Yeah. Yep.
But 75 years old, and at this point, we still don't have any other information. He was found dead in his New York apartment.
Several people pointed out on Facebook that during one of the more memorable scenes in the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High, that would be your fantasy scene with Phoebe Cates. It is the Cars
music. It wasn't my fantasy scene. You said your fantasy.
I meant to the collective.
Okay.
To many people listening, and by that I mean probably only most of the guys. Is that?
There probably are some women.
Some women also. But there's a scene in Fast Times in Ridgemont High where it's a fantasy sequence involving Phoebe Cates, and the Cars music is featured prominently because I was paying attention to the soundtrack.
Yes, I'm
not
sure
Phoebe
you
Cates,
were.
Like all the pervs. But remember that instrumental that plays in the background? As Phoebe Cates is emerging from the swimming pool, you're getting Cars music in the background, which made it even more delightful.
What song was that? How do you not know that?
Bum, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum.
Moving in Stereo?
Bum, bum, ba-dum, ba-dum. Yeah, Moving in Stereo.
That was the Phoebe Cates one.
Yes. The one time I saw that scene, I remembered.
That's pretty cute. You don't sing or bop very often.
I would never go back and watch it again. But now, because I want to make sure that was the song, Moving in Stereo, I may watch it again at some point. I don't know.
All right.
But it made for a more full scene, hearing that music in the background.
All right. Bye Bye Love was used in Super 8. I don't know what that movie is.
Oh, that's J.J. Abrams. That's like a throwback science fiction movie from 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago.
My Best Friend's Girl was used in My Best Friend's Girl with Kate Hudson.
Yes.
Did you see that movie?
Yes.
Was it good?
It was all right.
Drive was in the Transformers movie. And I believe, with Megan Fox, let's just say that.
Yeah.
I'm Not the One was in Billy Madison. And Moving in Stereo was the Phoebe Cates.
Yes.
Bah, bah, bah,
bah, bah, bah, bah, bah, very enjoyable.
And I liked his solo stuff. I was reading something about Rick Ocasek. And for years, everybody said Rick Ocasek. And then we found out it was Ocasek.
Mm-hmm.
Benjamin Orr sang, I believe, Drive. And
yes.
He died of pancreatic cancer, I think I read, in 2010.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize he had died so long ago.
Yeah.
And they were just inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame last year.
Yeah.
And Rick Ocasek was saying they had some really great albums that had, I mean, you look at top hits, they had so many number one hits and top 10. And then there was an album that wasn't that great, then a good one again, and then a bad one. And they said that they stopped being together because the last tour, they were miserable. So they said, we can't do this anymore. Let's stop. He had, do you remember a song called Emotion in Motion?
Yes.
I loved that song. That was Rick solo.
My favorite one of his was Why Can't I Have You? Did you ever hear that song?
No.
That's really good. I don't think it was one of, I think they had 14 top 40 hits, and I don't think that was one of them. But it was, that was my favorite song of theirs, because it came out during my high school years when everybody's asking themselves that question, when there's somebody.
You're such a romantic, you, it kills me.
You really hope for, and for some reason they're just not interested, and that song just came out at that time. It was perfect timing.
This is what is bothering me so much is, you know, Eddie Money, that was high school for me.
Yeah.
I mean, Two Tickets to Paradise.
Yeah.
Again, I loved watching his, I can't remember the name of his Access TV show, Real Money or
something. Real Money, that was it, yeah.
With his wife and his kids, and they toured with him. They were part of his band.
Mm-hmm.
And he just was a goof. He's a former policeman in New York City, and just,
isn't that crazy?
Yeah,
that's a job switch you don't see very often. To go from policeman to rock star doesn't happen that often.
No.
Even the police, Wendy, didn't have that.
Right.
If anybody, you'd think them, but no.
But so Eddie Money was part of our high school years. Definitely the Cars. It's like,
yeah,
this is a weird time in our lives.
Yeah. We had him on with us last year in the spring, April.
Okay, yeah.
And he was very candid, seemed to be having a good time. It's just, it was very, very sad.
And this just shows you what a nice guy he was. Chris Duffy, our production wizard over here at WGN Radio, was on the air, and I could be wrong. I think he said Muskegon or somewhere. Chris Duffy was on the air, and Eddie, the hotline rang, and he picked it up, and Eddie Money was on his way to a live show and was lost and said, how do I get to this venue?
Mm.
And Chris Duffy gave him directions, and I guess Eddie was like, I'm in an RV with my family, and they're driving me nuts. Can you help me get to this? And then Duffy gave him directions and said, while I have you, do you mind if we go on the air just for a quickie? And Eddie's like, sure, bro, let's go.
Oh.
And went on the air. Wow. That's just nice.
That's very nice. Very, very nice. So two very sad deaths from the world of music. I believe Greg Kot will be on with us tomorrow to explore their careers. That's confirmed, Jasmine? Yeah. 11:35, Greg Kot will be on to talk about both Eddie Money and Rick Ocasek.
Bye Bye Love is the top 10. That was a great Cars song.
Yes.
You're All I've Got Tonight.
Oh, so that's a great song.
Dangerous Type is one of my favorites.
Their greatest hits CD or album, depending on what you had at the time, or cassette, whatever you had the version of it. That's one of your greatest hits I've ever heard. Everyone, there's not a song on there that you don't go, oh, not this one.
My Best Friend's Girl.
Yeah, I love that.
Let's Go. Good Times Roll.
Mm.
I mean, All Mixed Up. I remember that song. Mm. Moving in Stereo. Phoebe Cates.
Yeah.
Did she have that at her wedding? Did she walk down the aisle to that, I
slowly
wonder? With Kevin Kline.
Yeah.
Are they still married?
Yeah. Yeah.
Drive is number two and the number one hit, according to ultimateclassicrock.com, is Just What I Needed.
Yeah. Those are all, that's a strong lineup of music right there. Very, very strong.
All right.
Very
well,
sad.
I'm sad.
Yep. All right. We'll take a break and then there's more show. Stick around, Bill and Wendy on WGN.
You're such a sap.
I love this song. This is one of my all time favorites.
I do remember this song.
I don't know that it made the top 40. I don't know, maybe.
What's it called?
Why Can't I Have You? Isn't this great? There's just so much orchestration behind it. So many levels.
A lot of synthesizers.
A lot of synthesizers.
You know what, though? They rock the synthesizers.
Yes.
I mean,
yep,
they were poppy. They were not like heavy-duty rock and rollers, but it still constituted rock and roll for
sure. No question. no question. But then they had so many really soft, easy ballads as well. They were all over the place, but it worked. They were great.
Somebody has called you a bonehead. I might be included in this.
Not discounting that on either charge.
You guys are such boneheads sometimes. Who doesn't know what Cars song that was when Phoebe Cates came out of that pool? Sheesh. But you knew it was bop, 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 bop.
I always thought that was the title of the song. Bop, bop. I went into Rose Records and asked for that. Do you guys have any bomp, 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 bottom, bottom? And I was all wet when I said it, too.
So bet you they got those kind of questions a lot. I bet you they did.
I'm sure they did.
Right.
Drive is my favorite Cars song. So haunting.
It is. It really is.
I've only seen that Phoebe Cates scene about 300 times. One of the finest movies of all times,
yep.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Yep.
Yes, Living in Stereo, one of the finest scenes ever.
Right. It's memorable.
Have you guys been watching any of, it may be old now, that CNN series, Movies? That was featured pretty prominently. It's a pretty good series.
Yeah, yeah. You know who else died over the weekend? This won't get much notice.
Is this part of the threesome? Because you have Eddie Money and Rico
I don't know.
Kasich.
Phyllis Newman. Do you remember her? She used to be on The Tonight Show quite often. I believe Johnny had a crush on her. I'm almost positive.
Listen to you.
Because every once in a while there'd be a guest on and you go, why is she on all the time?
But Billy Freud figured it out.
I did. And the thing I remember most about Phyllis Newman, she was a Broadway star in the 60s and the 70s, right? But the thing that I remember most about her is when Dan Aykroyd started doing an impression of Jimmy Carter on Saturday Night Live very, very early on. Remember the interview came out with Jimmy Carter in Playboy where he said that he has lusted after women
in
his heart?
I have lust in my heart.
But he wouldn't be specific on who. Well, Dan Aykroyd's version of Jimmy Carter was very specific that lust was pointed toward Phyllis Newman. I always thought that's such a bizarre, obscure person to pull a name out on, but I gave him credit for it.
That's such
a funny thing that's who he chose.
I'm looking at her and
you don't remember her?
No.
She'd be on The Tonight Show like every 2 or 3 months, and Johnny was just so smitten by her. He would just have this huge smile whenever she was on. What? Bom, 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 ba-dum, ba-dum.
Oh, that was Johnny's Moving in Stereo?
Yes.
All right. That's good to know.
All right. Eric Zorn is going to join us in just a little bit.
Is Eric Zorn walking out of the pool right now?
Eric Zorn is emerging from a pool. Misty.
He doesn't know what we're talking about.
Is this my new theme song? Because I kind of like it.
It's just for the
Fast
one day.
Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Phoebe Cates. Rico Kasich died.
Oh,
Cars.
Yeah. I know. Is there anything more this morning about circumstances of his death? I guess they don't know.
As of this morning, they were still saying that the cause of death was unknown. He was 75, so you're already getting into that area where it's natural causes.
That's not getting into that area. Come on, we're almost there.
No.
See, 10 years ago, I would have just nodded. Now I'm just like, no, Bill, don't go there.
No, 90 is that territory.
Louis C.K., back when he was a force to be reckoned with in the world of comedy, used to do this thing about him turning 50. And he goes, if you die when you're 49, everyone is mystified by it. How could he die? He's 49 years old, the guy's dead. The minute you turn 50, people go, yeah, well, the guy was 50.
Yeah, he lived a nice,
come on.
A nice long life,
right.
The ripe old age.
Right.
Yeah.
And that funny. Shouldn't make us laugh.
No.
But it did.
75 is still young.
Yes, it is.
Well, it's young to die suddenly like that, just to die overnight. I mean, people die of lingering long illnesses all the time at that age, but to be
I'm with you.
Day.
Yep.
So,
in happier news, the Chicago Bears shocked us all yesterday by winning over the Denver Broncos. And you wanted to talk about a tweet that came across from the Bears kicker, Eddie Pinero.
Well, it was really interesting because obviously it was a miraculous, seemingly miraculous victory.
I mean, that's a victory. I don't care what it was. I'll take it.
Had you given up? Honestly, had you given up 4th and 15, whatever it was? Had you just said, well, you know.
I didn't watch it. I found out later. I always watch the highlights package afterwards because it's not good for my heart to watch.
So you don't care, or you just
he doesn't care.
It's not.
He
not
based
that I don't
the whole
care.
Season on the first game, and when they got blown out by the Packers, he was done again.
I
for
always
this
watch
year.
The first game.
He tumbles off the bandwagon.
Yes,
the first guy off.
Yes,
you haven't been on the bandwagon in many.
It's been
years.
A long time. It has been a long time.
I'm a Bears fan. I'm stuck with them. Whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well. Anyway, as we know, as I'm sure all listeners know, Eddie Pinheiro hits a
long field
53-yard field goal with essentially, 1 second left to win the game by 2 points.
Yeah.
Right? And then afterwards on the field, he's being interviewed by Fox News or Fox Sports. And he says, "For everybody listening, man, if you don't believe in Jesus Christ, you better start because he's real. I promise you that."
Oh.
Says that during his on-field interview. And then he follows that up with a tweet that says, where's the tweet here? "If you don't believe in God, you better start believing he's real." Capital letters, R-E-A-L. And this,
but wouldn't God also be a fan of the Denver Broncos?
Well, not the Broncos.
No?
No.
Really? That's interesting.
He doesn't like those.
But I always wonder when the players are so thankful for what's happened and they thank Jesus and they thank God, I always think, but I think if everything was right in the universe, God would also be a fan of whatever team just beat you.
But they're thanking him for, they're thanking God or Jesus because that gave them the power to do something.
Yeah.
I don't mind when people thank him.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it is that there are, we're used to these expressions, you know, where they point to the sky or after the game, they say, you know, "All credit to my Lord and Savior."
Yes.
To God is the glory, and so on. And I look upon those as expressions of humility, in a way of saying, like I know that I didn't get here on my own. And, mm-hmm. and of course, none of us got where we are on our own, whether that's a religious outlook or whether you just look at your life and say, well, look at all the opportunities I got and look at the family that I have around me, the friends, the people who supported me, all the things that go into success. Now, whether you want that to include a religious view, but it always struck me as sort of an expression of humility. Like you say, you know what,
This
is bigger than I am, and I'm grateful for the opportunity and the gifts that I had, the blessings, if you will, that got me to a point where I could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of one thing in my mind, that kind of expression of of humility. This came across to me like a taunt. Like taunting non-believers and people who are, and non-Christians, like, "You don't believe in Jesus?
How about this?
How about that field goal? How about that?" And it really clanged as far as I was concerned. I thought it was like a sort of absurd and almost offensive.
But couldn't you say, where was God a year ago when Eddie Pinheiro was making or trying to make similar kicks and not succeeding?
God hated Cody Parkey.
He must have.
Oh, my God, yes. Just double doink. Are you kidding me? He was like, right. God, I was there going, like, how about a doink? No.
Nah.
And one of the angels said, "Hey, wait, I have a right. better." Wait.
I don't think you should knock people for having a relationship with God.
No, but he was beyond a relationship. This was him saying to any of you non-believers, "We just proved that religion exists. We just proved it with that kick."
I guess.
Yeah. It just went way too far. And so he's 24 years old, right?
Yeah.
He's like really excited. He was 3 for 3. He won the darn game.
Yes, he did.
He's the leading scorer of the Bears by a lot this year. So there's a lot to be said for what he did and how he did it. And I do understand that. But I think, you know, when you take a step back from that, it's like,
right.
Look at what you just said here.
Yeah.
You just said that this field goal proves that your theological outlook is correct. And of course, this opens him up for the inevitable time when he's going to miss a big kick, because it happens to every pro kicker.
So how will he explain that?
God was busy that day.
He's going to say, I guess this, or does it mean that if those of us who are offended by this can go and say, well, I guess this proves God is make believe,
or put $20 down in Minnesota.
Yeah, right.
So as he will do.
So I just sort of put that thought onto social media today, and a lot of people responded to it.
What was the most common response?
A lot of people were striking the tone that Wendy was striking, which is like, you know, kind of, yeah, technically you're right. Give the guy a break.
Mm-hmm.
He's a hero, and just, you know, he came through this this whole process of the Bears trading for him at the end, and all the pressure on the new kicker, and he succeeded, and he, so he blurts out something that reflects what's in his heart. Give him a break. So that's
that was said much better than I said.
I would say that's the Wendy Snyder take on this.
Watch any championship game or series in the waning moments of the game when they show the audience. As the game is close, and you pick your sport, it could be basketball, it could be baseball, it could be hockey, football, whatever. You see so many people in the audience with their hands in prayer position, and it's why they're not doing that the rest of the game, but at the end of the game,
I think they're waiting to clap. I don't know that. I think they're just getting their arms poised and ready to clap.
But you see so many people.
Come on, Bill.
So before clapping, you want to put your hands in clap position?
But before? I've done that before when I'm not praying. It's just like you kind of put your arms up like your chicken wings and up to your mouth like, oh, come on. Yeah. Yes. Oh,
all right.
Yeah. I mean, the problem when you're, of course, when you're.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah? All right.
Wouldn't you be holding your hands like apart, like about 3 inches apart so that
that's
you're ready?
Your better. You get the noise right away.
So you're like the first one when the free throw
goes in. No, but you're kind of like gripping something like Simon Bar Sinister, you know? Like,
yeah. Simon Bar Sinister.
Come on. Let's go.
Or you're holding hands like the ball players do on the bench in basketball games. So all the players
sometimes they'll hold hands
on the line. That's right. Yep.
They
sweet.
Do?
Yeah, sometimes you'll see that.
You see that, yeah.
It's their
expression of solidarity.
But you don't see the prayer pre-clap. You don't see that during the whole game until you're down to those last few key moments.
Well, it's very tense. I get that people are doing something with their hands. And of course, the idea that you can pray and that if you pray hard enough, your team is going to make the free throw or get the touchdown.
So does God, is it a numbers game where he says, I'm watching the game, I'm watching the Bears in Denver, and more people want the Bears to win, so I'm going to grant them that?
Is less that sinners on the team is how he goes.
He goes by that?
There are less sinners on the Bears.
We'll make them win.
Every time Notre Dame does really well, you hear that. That's the claim from the Notre Dame faithful, is that that God is smiling on Notre Dame. I would like to think...
Yes,
this is not the case. It reminds me a little bit of when like Jerry Falwell and those guys would say, "Oh, the hurricane struck Louisiana because there are so many sinners in New Orleans." Like, no. And then, of course, when a tornado rips through the Bible Belt, they're like, "Oh,
right.
Who knows? Satan, you know."
Yeah,
it's just like you never know.
Yep.
So it just seems like one of those things where I appreciate the expression of humility in a case like that. I think that's really an important lesson for everybody, which is like, hey, you know. All the things in Eddie Pinheiro's life that led up to him being able to have the skill to kick that ball that far and have the opportunity to be there to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were a lot of things that worked together, and how, whatever you want to ascribe that to, you can't say, well, I'm just the greatest, and that's why. And no matter where I was born or who, you know, into what circumstance or what country, I would have been here to do that. That's obviously not true. So you can, you know, however you want to ascribe all the circumstances that led him to be there, and thank goodness he made it, right?
Yep.
Or thank God.
Yes. Yes. All right. Thank you. More with Eric Zorn in just a little bit. Bill and Wendy, WGN. Eric Zorn is here, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Wasn't it nice to see your fellow mincing rascal get recognized on Friday?
It was really nice that I went to the hall. Is it
the Walk of Fame?
Walk of Fame.
Yeah.
There's no walk anymore, but
not currently. They're scouting out a new location.
Well, it's still over there, isn't it?
It's over there by Tribune Tower, but...
under the scaffold.
It's a little dangerous to take it all in.
Really, there's a guy, one of the MCs looked a lot like you, but he didn't have a baseball hat, so I don't know who that was.
Wow. Ryan Reynolds, probably.
It was really a nice event.
Yeah.
I had no idea. I just thought that they were going to gather in a circle and say, there you go. You're in the Walk of Fame now. Yeah,
now it's bigger.
No, it's really nice. Yeah. Does any other broadcast outlet in town do that? I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think we're the
Tribune,
only ones.
They're not worthy.
Tribune doesn't have a Walk of Fame, although what we do have is in our new offices, we have all these little glassed-in meeting rooms, and they're all named for people who've won Pulitzer Prizes.
Oh, that's impressive.
That's kind of cool. So
that's
like
nice.
There's a Mary Schmeek room and
so on.
So
I saw Mary, by the way, in front of the Tribune. She was taking pictures. For people who don't know, the Tribune Tower is part of it is being demolished, not the part up front, because that's landmark status, so they can't demolish that. But the whole back part where all the offices were, it looks like it's been bombed out.
It was just, yeah, well, and that was just an old addition that they put on
right.
sometime in the 50s or something. It was really pretty ugly.
But Mary was out taking pictures last week.
Her office was right there on the
window. Yeah, she showed us where her office was. And it was very emotional for her, as it should be.
Yeah, it was emotional leaving that place. It was about, it was well over a year ago that we left that building.
Yeah.
And the thing is that our new offices are really much better.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it doesn't
look... But the history's not there. I
mean, you don't look like you're walking into a... You don't feel like you're walking into a cathedral anymore. We're in the Prudential Building. And
right.
It's like we just walk in. But the, you know, the desks and everything, it's cleaner and everything else. So it's better to be... Hey, speaking of Mary, have you heard this BBC Two documentary they did? You know, it's the 20-year anniversary that her Always Wear Sunscreen. You remember this famous
The Buzz Lehrman version, right?
Yeah. That she wrote a column in 1997. It was advice to graduates. And it was just, you know, it was one of these things, she walking to work, didn't know what she was going to write about. And she literally saw a woman sunbathing out on Oak Street Beach and said, you know, this poor girl, I hope she's wearing sunscreen because she's going to pay for it.
Because
Mary feels like if she had worn sunscreen, she would have been much better off when she was younger. So she writes this column, Always Wear Sunscreen, and then had these other bits of advice. And then at the end says, but just take my advice on the sunscreen if you don't listen to me. So this column goes viral in the way that things did in 1997. It gets passed around a lot. It gets attributed to Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah.
And then Baz Luhrmann picks it up. The Australian
filmmaker
and impresario. He makes a record. The record goes to number one in the UK and Australia. And they did an entire hour-long documentary about the advice in this column, and about the song, how the song came to be, and then they had Mary record some of it, and they put her reading it over the music.
It was a very unlikely hit. Would you agree? Even though it's a great column, you wouldn't think, well, this will turn itself into a number one hit record.
What was the song? Because I even heard her on with John Williams talking about
Everybody's
this.
Free, I think it was the song. The title of the song was Everybody's Free to Wear Sunscreen. I think it's a sort of a mashup. And they interview people for whom the lyrics of that song still really resonate about, you know, being kind to your knees because you miss them when they're gone and things like that. There's all kinds of like little wry asides and the documentary is really, it's amazing. I saw Mary sent me the link and I was like, an hour? Really? About one column? I don't know, Mary. But it really is, it's great.
It's fascinating.
It's great listening,
but you know what's interesting? It's strange that we're talking about this today. We talked to Keir Dulay from the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey.
Yeah.
And the way that message is delivered in that song always reminded me of the way HAL 9000 spoke in 2001, just very calm, even though it's the voice of reason, but there's danger behind the voice.
I can't do that, Bill.
Wear sunscreen. If I could offer you only one tip for the future, sunscreen would be it. The long-term benefits of sunscreen have been proved by scientists.
Does it kick in?
The rest of my trying to solve an algebra.
This is where this is the kick in.
This is where you start dancing.
A real trouble.
And this is all inspired by Mary Schmidt.
By Mary's column.
It's totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And she says that one of the reasons why it got the momentum that it got, she thinks, is because it was attributed originally to Kurt Vonnegut. People said, this is Kurt Vonnegut's graduation speech at MIT.
Right.
Kurt Vonnegut never spoke at graduation at MIT. And Kurt Vonnegut was amused by this, by the confusion.
And she called him.
She called him. She said she had one like blinding moment of fear, which is like, did somehow I write this and steal it from Kurt Vonnegut without knowing?
Oh,
you know,
wow.
You might tell a joke sometime and go, wait a minute, so Mary says it's by far the weirdest thing that's ever happened to her. that she gets this, she writes this column, and I wrote this really wonderful column about how giving nose hair clippers is, I think, the best gift you could give to somebody.
Yeah.
And I don't know why I haven't had a hit song with that.
Well, I remember Prince picked up on it, and he turned that into a song that didn't do well.
It just never did well.
No,
I'm really bummed about that. So.
Great to see you, Eric.
Good to see
Thank you,
We'll
Eric.
See you a week from today. That's Eric Zorn of the Chicago Tribune. Coming up, the stories that matter with Don Kleppen from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.